I'm John Wynn with SDPB News. All three members of South Dakota's congressional delegation voted against the latest COVID relief bill. They say the $1.9 trillion legislation is too broad and expensive. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
Democrats passed the bill with no Republican support. The bill includes direct payments to many Americans, extended unemployment benefits, money for vaccine distribution and school reopenings, and other pandemic-related items. South Dakota state and local governments will get $1 billion. Republicans objected to funding for other Democratic priorities, like health care subsidies, the National Endowment for the Arts, and failing employer pension plans. Senator John Thune and his South Dakota colleagues voted for previous COVID relief bills during the Trump presidency. But Thune says some of that money remains unspent, and the country is past the worst of the health crisis.
I mean, I've talked to cities in South Dakota who couldn't figure out how to spend the money. So, I'm not saying that there wasn't a need to do something. I'm just saying there wasn't a need to do this. And this certainly could have been done in a bipartisan way, in a way that was much more fiscally responsible and targeted.
Thune's Senate colleague Mike Rounds also voted against the bill. So did Representative Dusty Johnson, who says the bill should have been more tightly focused on areas of need.
It seems to me that during the depths of a crisis, you know, a wartime investment to combat that challenge is only appropriate. Toward the end of the challenge, investing those kind of dollars in a series of unrelated governmental spending provisions, I would view very differently.
South Dakotans who are eligible based on income stand to receive thousands of dollars. That includes $1,400 for every person and dependent, plus a $3,000 tax credit for each child. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Seth Tupper.
The South Dakota Department of Health says the state is expanding the list of people eligible for the coronavirus vaccine. Health officials say the remainder of individuals in Priority Group D who are now eligible include teachers, childcare workers, college staff, college students in dormitories, and funeral workers. Healthcare providers have administered more than 262,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine. More than 86,000 people have received two doses. The Department of Health says 30% of the state's population has received at least one dose. Advocates for recreational marijuana in South Dakota argue that the future of the ballot initiative process is at stake as the state Supreme Court weighs a voter-passed constitutional amendment to legalize marijuana. South Dakota voters in November passed a constitutional amendment legalizing marijuana, but a state circuit judge in January struck that down as unconstitutional. Marijuana advocates have appealed to the Supreme Court in a case that will determine whether recreational pot becomes legal in the state. For weather today, we're seeing sunny skies across the state with highs in the mid-30s in the southwest and northeast to the lower 50s north-central and southeast. Later tonight, mostly clear skies with lows in the upper teens to the upper 20s. Expect some patchy fog in the northeast over the night. On Friday, mostly sunny skies with highs in the upper 30s to the lower 50s. Evening lows in the lower 20s to the lower 30s. Coming up next, it's In the Moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
March 11th, 2020 was the day many Americans realized the pandemic would change the way we live. 1 year later, how close are we to the end of this crisis?
We have this artificial idea that it will end on a certain day, but what's more likely to be the case is that the pandemic will have a very, very long tail, and it will end unevenly.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Touchmark at All Saints, where life for people 55 plus means maintenance-free living, with meals, activities, and more, all close to downtown Sioux Falls, celebrating 40 years of hospitality. More at touchmark.com.
SDPB brings you the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament. You can catch all the action Thursday, March 11th through Saturday, March 13th. For more information, including multiple ways to watch the games live, go to sdpb.org/basketball. Complete coverage of the South Dakota Girls State Basketball Tournament is brought to you by Dakota Bank and SD Corn.
State House coverage provided by Boyce Law Firm, building lasting relationships that transcend generations, representing a variety of industries and employment matters, including defense of workers' comp claims, experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A bill banning the abortion of fetuses with Down syndrome reached the governor's desk with little friction. It's a priority of Governor Kristi Noem's this year. SDPB's Lee Sturbinger has more.
At the start of this legislative session, Governor Kristi Noem outlined her priorities in the State of the State address. One creates a new distinction to the state's strict abortion laws. It makes abortion of a fetus with Down syndrome a felony. As the proposal worked its way through the legislative process, Tammy Fite sat in front of the House State Affairs Committee. She and her 17-year-old son, Cody Fite, came to testify in favor of Governor Kristi Noem's proposal. Cody has Down syndrome. The Fites have another daughter with special needs.
We looked at what might have been pros and cons, and we chose life to give them and life abundantly.
The Fite family is from Platte. They adopted Cody knowing he had Down syndrome. Tammy Fite says abortions should not be an option for a fetus with such a diagnosis.
We are one family from South Dakota that was willing to adopt a child with Down syndrome. We are not the only ones.
It's not clear how many abortions are performed because of a Down syndrome diagnosis. Governor Kristi Noem wants to know.
We don't know what's happening here in South Dakota. We do know we do have babies that are born with Down syndrome. We don't know how many are being aborted specifically because they are diagnosed with Down syndrome. But what this is saying is here in South Dakota, every single life has value.
The bill has sailed through the state legislature with no votes against it. One Republican lawmaker says the bill doesn't go far enough. Representative David Anderson says mothers should be criminalized for aborting a fetus with Down syndrome.
But I think it's time we have a further conversation. There cannot be one innocent party and one guilty party. And I'm dead serious about that. I think we all need to take responsibility for our actions, including the mother.
South Dakota bans abortions after 20 weeks. The Mayo Clinic says first trimester screenings that could detect Down syndrome occur around 11 to 14 weeks. Those screenings have an 85% accuracy rate. The Planned Parenthood facility in Sioux Falls is the only abortion provider in the state. Kristen Hayward works for Planned Parenthood of the Dakotas in Minnesota. She says abortions in the state are provided up until 13 and a half weeks. Hayward says most testing isn't done until past that point.
Whether it's a ban or a limitation or the 72-hour waiting period or anything like that is just not trusting the women of South Dakota to make their own medical decisions.
The state legislature rejected a similar bill 7 years ago. Elizabeth Nash is with the Guttmacher Institute, a public policy organization that focuses on sexual and reproductive rights in the U.S. In a written statement, Nash says Governor Noem's bill is part of a strategy to create so many restrictions that abortion is nearly impossible to access. Nash says bans like these are designed to prevent women from getting a legal abortion. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals has upheld an injunction on a similar bill that passed in Arkansas. The ruling says pre-viability abortion bans are not constitutional. It says laws like this stand in the way of a pregnant woman's ability to exercise her right to terminate a pregnancy before viability. Democratic State Representative Aaron Healy says the governor and legislature should focus on disability rights to ensure those with Down syndrome and other disabilities have what they need to succeed in life.
We've had this discussion so many times, but I know that community service providers really need more money in terms of funds for their employees. So I would really encourage us to focus on on other ways that we can really help that community out.
The president of an advocacy group for families agrees. Brandon Tillis is the president of the board of directors for New Directions Down Syndrome. The organization represents about 2,000 families with connections to Down syndrome. Tillis says the organization does not have a position on the bill, but was surprised by it.
that the governor would sort of move forward with this type of legislation, and that as an organization that has a really deep tie to this issue, that it isn't something that we were, you know, contacted about or involved in, but we would have liked to have been.
Tillis says life expectancy for people with Down syndrome has doubled in the last decade. Echoing some of Representative Healey's sentiments, Tillis says more support is essential.
I'm not sure that the government apparatuses to help assist with that dramatically increased scope of, you know, age, capabilities, medical needs, etc., has been able to keep pace with the medicine and the science behind it.
That's why New Directions provides families with information and resources on what to expect when having a child with Down syndrome. Tillis says bringing families together for more support is crucial. Governor Kristi Noem is expected to have a signing ceremony for the legislation. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strupinger in Pierre.
You can find that story and more on our website, sdpb.org/news. Now, Governor Kristi Noem says her approach to the pandemic in South Dakota both honored her constitutional role as governor and helped the state's economy thrive during disruption. In Sioux Falls, Mayor Paul Tenhaken broke the tie to end the citywide mask mandate in spite of its apparent effectiveness. And in Pierre, lawmakers have been grappling with abortion legislation and what to do about a voter-approved call for medical marijuana. The pandemic has been packed with nuanced decisions and emotional testimony, not all of them about public health. David Wiltsey is Associate Professor of Political Science at SDSU, and he's joining us today with insight. Professor Wiltsey, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm hoping we can start, because I'm really curious to hear, 1 year after, you know, the first cases and the first deaths of COVID-19 reported in South Dakota, it's time when a lot of people are sort of revisiting the highs and lows of the pandemic and sort of reframing the narrative or putting things into context. You know, we're hearing things like we never shut down. But businesses, you know, we talked yesterday on the show, Dave, about businesses across the state. Many, many municipalities did engage in various restrictions, from mask mandates to shutdowns. Even some churches, you know, said they went virtual for an extended period of time. Schools did remote learning. So I'm wondering, as you watch the year turn and see Governor Noem on the national news and some of the way she is talking about the decisions she made in South Dakota, from a political science perspective, what are you seeing unfold in that messaging?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it really is kind of reframing, you know, the narrative of this whole debate. And, you know, when you read things like this, particularly these post hoc justifications of what policymakers have done, I mean, it really just kind of highlights how this, from the very start, was approached from a very partisan perspective. And, you know, what I found kind of interesting about this piece, even though it wasn't explicit in her justification of this, is, you know, she was really making some points about how there are always policy trade-offs. And obviously, I think it's safe to say that virtually every policymaker out there over the past year, even before the pandemic really was officially called a pandemic and before we started taking decisive policy approaches or decisive policy measures, most, you know, took this partisan frame. And, you know, in the end, you know, there is some interesting things she has to say in here about these trade-offs. And, you know, I think, you know, this trade-off that we have made between economic performance and public health is, you know, it's worthy of a discussion.
Yeah. It was always nuanced in many ways. And I remember the governor and others saying,
You know, Dr. Wendell Hoffman was on the program saying, you know, people are deferring health care, you know, for example, because they're afraid to go to the hospital. There was always this nuance of, will there be a mental health crisis? Will there be, you know, the desperation that comes from so many people losing their jobs at the same time? At what point does it become just these talking points, though, where we just say, this state was the eighth highest per capita death rate, therefore they failed, or this state never shut down and our kids are in school, therefore we succeeded in a way that no one else has? Like, what is that tendency to just go toward the, you know, zero sum game?
Well, I think for the most part, this discussion still, at least in the popular media, is just that. It's talking points. And I mean, take the school issue, for example. I mean, that is still something that Democrats and liberals are, you know, very stubborn on, even though the science on this really does point to schools being fairly safe. I mean, not, it's, you know, transmission obviously happens at schools, but for the most part, this has not been the kind of center of super spreading that we initially thought it was. Yet, we still, you know, we still kind of default to these partisan cues that we're taking. And in this particular case, there is damage that's being done to our kids. So, I mean, she does make some good points in those.
Yeah, I default to the partisan cues. I like that. That is something that everyone seems to have.
Yeah.
Is that does that go away when we're distracted with other things, or does
doesn't.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was
I
afraid
it's
that
ever
was
present.
The answer.
Yeah.
It's ever present. Yeah.
As soon as something, you know, takes on that partisan tinge, I think it's really hard to shed that. And for whatever reason, we very quickly adopted a partisan frame in our response to this pandemic. And, you know, that's why I say, in so many respects, this op-ed that she posted yesterday or the day before was very much post hoc. I mean, how often did you hear her talk about things that she raised in this article prior to this op-ed, or especially at the beginning of the pandemic? I mean, I don't follow her every word, but the issue of suicide, you know, I'd never heard that before. And I really struggle to believe that that was something that was central in the decision making back at the beginning of the pandemic. And it's just a tendency that we have whenever we are trying to justify these past actions, we're going to grab at these little straws. And, you know, even though it is true that South Dakota suicide rate looks like it will be lower than many other states in the union right now, I just can't believe that was right there at the center of the decision making back then. So
that's a really interesting thing to
political thought.
Yeah.
So.
To follow up on, as because the reports we've had is that mental health crisis, you know, maybe it's not the actual, you know, suicides, but just people in need has gone up here in South Dakota as well.
And
with the guests,
you know,
that we
don't have
had on the program
data on this either at this point.
Right.
So it's a little premature to be making those kind of judgments. So
I want to talk a little bit with you about this other debate going on about initiated measure 26, which is medical marijuana. And we have watched in the State House, it's sort of, you know, a rise and fall and then a failed compromise. And now it's looking more and more like in July 1st, the measure will stand and it will be as the people voted on it. As we watch state lawmakers grapple with what we call direct democracy or the initiated and referendum process, there is an ongoing effort to restrict the influence of voters going directly to make legislation. It's not a new thing, for sure, but it is a continued focus of lawmakers in peer. What are your thoughts as that has sort of unfolded regarding medical marijuana?
Yeah, it's, you know, we're seeing the same trend in a lot of states. I mean, so South Dakota is not alone in this. So, I mean, we have seen in a lot of states that have public initiatives, you know, efforts similar to this to really scale it back. And, you know, political scientists have always kind of had a skeptical view of initiatives and referenda, particularly initiatives, because it can lead to a very disjointed policy picture where states will simultaneously vote for things that are directly contradictory to each other. But in this case, you know, this really is a case where the elected representatives of South Dakota are just different in terms of their opinion on these two policy issues, particularly the recreational marijuana initiative. And, you know, they're looking for ways to restrain the voters, because this is one area where they don't have a lock on the policy process. So by creating a 60% threshold for measures that are, I forget what the cutoff is, 10 million or some kind of expenditure or any kind of tax, you know, that is one way that they'll be able to put the brakes on some of these things that just run counter to their policy platform.
Is there a connection between, stick with me here, the idea of an initiated measure and individuals being able to, you know, vote for something that, that maybe policymakers disagree with, and the sort of individual resistance to wearing a mask? You know, I don't want my government to tell me this. It infringes upon my freedom. I'm talking about like sort of individualism versus community. Are those two things connected at all from a political science perspective?
I wouldn't think so. I think this is just kind of a, you know, like you said, a continuing trend of a tension between the policymakers and the mass public. The mass public can at times get well ahead of our political institutions in terms of policy preference. And in this particular case, I think the legislature was just caught off guard by the success of both of these measures. And, you know, we've seen these tensions in the past. A couple of years ago, we had the lobbying and campaign finance initiated measure pass, and, you know, almost immediately rescinded by the legislature in the very next session under an emergency provision,
right.
So it would take effect right away. So this is just normal. And, you know, again, this is just one of these things that policymakers have always been suspect of, or policymakers have used it as a way to kind of push aside an issue that they don't want to deal with.
Right.
Whenever a tax issue or these sorts of things come up and they don't want to take a decisive stand, oftentimes we'll see it pushed down to the electorate, knowing full well that the electorate is going to reject the measure. So, you know, it's just part of the landscape when it comes to popular initiatives.
Yeah. Dave Wiltsie is Associate Professor of Political Science at SDSU. Thanks so much for being here with us today. Always a pleasure.
Thanks again. Glad you're back.
Thank you. Up next, prohibiting certain social media censorship. Lawmakers in Pierre try to debate and pass legislation. We'll hear about that in just a minute. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
There were some businesses that had to close their doors, go online, and wait out the pandemic, and it worked out all right. Tougher, though, for some.
I really want to connect with people. I want to show them kind of the joys of handcraft. And suddenly, you know, our whole model is now online.
I'm Kai Rizdal. How they are getting through, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. 50,000 miles of resilient broadband fiber supporting online banking and other essential businesses right where you need it. More at sdncommunications.com.
This week on Planet Money, comic book team, assemble! We bring our very own superhero to life with the help of comic book experts. And on how I built this, how traveling frugally inspired Rick Steves to start a $100 million brand.
They wanted to produce shows that would be pleasant to watch, and I wanted to produce shows that would teach the Rick Steves style of travel.
That's coming up on the next Planet Money, and how I built this from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 2 Central, 1 Mountain.
Program funding is provided by Yak Ridge Cabins and Farmstead. Your year-round Black Hills adventure awaits with private cabins, modern amenities, and Himalayan yaks. Social distance stays minutes from Mount Rushmore and Hill City. More at yak-ridge.com.
In Their Own Words brings you closer to the debates and conversations behind legislative topics. It's supported by SDN Communications.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. For today's In Their Own Words segment, we listen in on testimony regarding concerns about today's social media climate. In light of recent moves to delete some social media accounts, lawmakers considered House Bill 1223 that would prohibit certain social media censorship.
House Bill 1223, an act to prohibit certain social media censorship.
House Bill 1223, having had its second reading, is now up for consideration and final passage. Further remarks, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker.
Wrong side.
Wrong side again, yes. This morning, I was in local government, and I heard the chair repeatedly tell some of the testifiers, brevity is your friend. So in keeping with that theme, because we have a busy, busy day, I will not go through all four pages that I have of notes for this bill. So, House Bill 1223 deals with big tech censorship, which has become a big, big problem in our country. What did Facebook do to Australia? The social networking company on Wednesday said that people and publishers in Australia will no longer be able to share or see any news from local or international outlets. The decision appears to be the most restrictive move Facebook has ever taken against content publishers. Recently, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis announced a major push to curb big tech's political bias and censorship with measures including a ban on the censorship of political candidates and mandatory opt-outs of content filters for citizens of the Sunshine State. The governor identified big tech companies as the leading threat to American democracy and freedom of expression today. South Dakota is joining other states, 26 to be exact, in bringing legislation that will address this travesty. A state law solution in the form of House Bill 1223 that causes deceptive trade practice law to catch up to modern-day technology is the best solution to the ongoing problem of social media censorship. I would appreciate your support of House Bill 1223. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further remarks, House Bill 1223, further remarks. Further remarks. Representative Odenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This bill passed the Judiciary Committee, and I listened to the testimony and spoke on it in Judiciary. Hadn't necessarily planned to talk about this today, but thought I would. I think this bill is good for the main reason that it sends a good message. One of the things we talked about in Judiciary Committee was the idea of monopoly. And it got me thinking that in 1911 or thereabouts, this country broke up the Standard Oil monopoly because they had a monopoly on a very precious commodity of oil. And now these big tech companies, it seems to me, have a monopoly on the even more precious commodity, which is our free speech. And I don't know if this bill is perfect, but it's a good start in sending a message that in South Dakota, we're probably not going to just sit back and let the big tech companies get to decide without there being any consequences who gets to say what. So I'd ask you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you. Further remarks, Representative Haugard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I likewise would support this bill. It wasn't too long ago that my wife and I traveled to another country, and it was a communist country, And on the way over on the flight, we were advised that we would not engage in any speech which was political or involved religion. So really made me appreciate the fact that we do have freedom and that we have freedom to express ourselves, we have freedom to communicate as we choose to, and no one should be in a position to suppress that but for some very rare exceptions. So I'm in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, I'm going to stand and ask you to resist this bill. You know, a good representative from Spearfish started to talk about antitrust, okay? And I think that's actually where the issue lies here. I don't think it has to do with a bill like this that allows them not to actually take your remarks off of their system. When we get on Facebook, when we get on Twitter, we know that it's for free. And there's rules. And the company that owns it can publish it, or can publishes the rules and tells you what the rules are. We're at their mercy. But they're not a public utility. They're a private company. And so that's why I don't think this is fair. If we really have an issue, then let's go after, I think there's antitrust issues. I think we need to break up the trusts and figure that out instead, because they do. They own too much of the business space, and I think we need to break that up. So for those reasons, I ask you to resist this motion. Thank you.
Thank you for the remarks. Further remarks? Hearing no further remarks, Representative Jensen, would you like to close out the debate?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. There's probably not many in this room that haven't been censored one way or another when you've been on Facebook. I was talking with a group of 90 Republicans or so a week ago, and I asked, how many of you have been censored? And you wouldn't believe the number of hands that shot up, you know, from being censored on Facebook and on YouTube and some of these various forums. So I would encourage you to take an active step and help South Dakota be a leader in reining in big tech. Thank you.
Thank you. Question before the body is final passage of House Bill 1223. All those in favor will vote yea. Those opposed, nay. Madam Clerk, please unlock the voting machine. Will the members proceed to vote?
Mr. Speaker, all members have voted.
Please display the vote.
Mr. Speaker, there were ayes 32, nays 37, excused 1.
House Bill 1223, having failed to receive a vote of the majority of the members elect, is hereby declared lost.
House Bill 1223, yes, lost to the session. You can hear the complete hearing testimony at SD.net. Follow the South Dakota Legislature link in the meeting archives section. A Stand Your Ground bill shot down by the Senate Judiciary Committee has been resurrected and approved by the full Senate. Supporters of House Bill 1212 say the bill clears up vague and outdated language in current self-defense statutes, but lawyers in the legislature say the bill replaces current self-defense law, wipes out decades of case law that interprets what self-defense is and is not. Victoria Wicks tracks this bill as it travels through committees and chambers on its way to the governor's desk.
Representative Kevin Jensen is a prime sponsor of House Bill 1212, the Stand Your Ground bill based on a 2005 Florida law. He also teaches gun safety and rights.
Just about 2,000 people have come through my classes, and I get the same question in every class. And that's when it comes to the display of force rather than the use of force. And this bill attempts to clarify that, a lot of that.
Jensen says his students want to know if state law allows them to simply brandish a weapon and use it as a deterrent rather than pointing the gun and pulling the trigger.
Our current laws are very confusing, vague, and don't really justify certain actions by people.
Jensen says this bill clears that up by defining what a reasonable person can do when placed in fear of great bodily harm or death. Jensen notes that South Dakota has relaxed legal restrictions on firearms.
We now allow anybody in the United States to come here and carry a gun.
And he says these armed out-of-staters need to know under what circumstances they can defend themselves. But Jensen says parts of the state's self-defense laws are 100 years old, with antiquated language that, in Jensen's words, make us look stupid. The bill passes through the House State Affairs Committee by a vote of 10-1. Now the bill moves to the full House, slightly amended. Representative Kevin Jensen again introduces it. Representative Ryan Schwach is a lawyer from Yankton. He asked Jensen a question.
I wanted to focus on Section 7 here. What is the import of this presumption of unlawful entry?
Section 7 says a person who unlawfully enters or attempts to enter a dwelling, residence, or occupied vehicle is presumed to be doing so with the intent to commit a crime of force or violence. Jensen offers an explanation.
We're seeing, especially in the Sioux Falls area, is a lot of people are not locking their doors. People are walking in and attacking people, and they're walking in to steal things.
Schwach shares an incident that happened to a friend.
The neighbor next door just had a little too much to drink down at Carrie's, and he walked into the wrong apartment when he got to the building. Under this section, does that authorize the resident of that apartment to shoot the drunk who came into the room?
Jensen says no.
You still have to be able to justify your violence. You still have to be able to justify that. If you hurt somebody, yes, you're going to probably get arrested. You don't just get to shoot for free. I'm sorry, that's just not the way the real world works.
Schwach disagrees. He says the language in the bill doesn't distinguish a situation when someone accidentally enters where he or she doesn't belong.
That happens. People make mistakes. But under this, if that person does that, regardless of whether it's an accident or not, this law creates a presumption that that person is entering with an intent to commit an unlawful act involving force or violence. And when you read that with the rest of the bill, that gives that owner a lot of power to use deadly force. And that's just asking for a tragedy.
Schwach encourages representatives to vote the bill down, but the House approves it 61-7. Now the Stand Your Ground bill goes to the Senate Judiciary. That 7-member committee contains 5 lawyers, including 2 retired judges. The committee hears from Brian Gosch, a lawyer, former legislator, and lobbyist for the National Rifle Association. Gosch says the NRA has supported Stand Your Ground bills all across the country, holding that self-defense should not include a duty to retreat, even if retreat is possible. He gives an example of ineffective gun laws in Texas in 2017 at Sutherland Springs.
At the time, Texas had a no guns in church rule in statute. A bad guy came in and started shooting up the parishioners.
26 people died in that shooting, and 20 more were injured. Gosch says Texas then changed its law, and in 2019 there was a different outcome in a similar incident in the town of White Settlement.
In that case, a parishioner pulled out his sidearm after 2 men had already been killed, and he shot the bad guy in the head.
Gosch characterizes bill opponents as believing that parishioners should flee as a first resort and would want the gunman's family to be able to sue the parishioner who stayed to fight rather than retreating.
I don't think that's South Dakota, and I think in South Dakota we're helpful to people, whether it's helping them change a tire or protecting them in a self-defense situation.
One of the opponents is Taniza Islam, a lawyer, lobbyist, and executive director for South Dakota Voices for Peace and Voices for Justice. She says as she reads House Bill 1212, any person could use deadly force to prevent any felony anywhere under any circumstances.
Allowing civilians to enforce laws based on their assumptions and suspicions makes us all vulnerable to increased shootings and homicides, and more particularly, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color.
Islam reminds legislators of the death in Florida of Trayvon Martin, who was shot and killed when George Zimmerman questioned why the black teen was walking through his neighborhood. Islam says the growing diversity in South Dakota increases the possibility of that same type of conflict under this law.
To me and my boys and the thousands of black and brown people in our state, it is a reality we live in every day.
This is a colorblind bill. Absolutely.
Islam's testimony is rebutted by Representative Kevin Jensen.
I train church security teams, and I've had 3 security teams from mosques in Sioux Falls. I don't care who comes to me to learn about self-defense and what the rules, and I mean, it doesn't matter to me who they are. So I'm training Christian churches, mosques, every, absolutely, it is a colorblind issue.
At the end of testimony, the Senate Judiciary votes the bill down by 4-2, with one excused. That hearing takes place on March 4th. Later the same day, the full Senate smokes out the bill, and 4 days after that, it's up for floor debate. Prime sponsor John Wick carries the bill in the Senate.
House Bill 1212 actually introduces the possibility of reasonable force.
Wick says the definition of reasonable force is hidden in case law, not accessible to non-attorneys. He notes that the lawyers in the legislature have opposed this law because they say it's not necessary.
And for them it's not, because they get it. They understand. They can read the case law. They know where to find it. They know how to interpret it. The rest of us don't.
One of the lawyers in the Senate is David Wheeler, who points out if this bill passes, all that case law developed over decades will no longer apply. But he says that's not the only problem with House Bill 1212. Wheeler reads the definition of forcible felony, a term used in the bill.
Arson, assault, burglary, kidnapping, manslaughter, murder, rape, and robbery, and any other felony that involves the use or threat of physical force or violence against a person.
Wheeler says these words are so broad they include crimes that put no one's life in danger.
The word assault is nowhere else defined in this bill. Under South Dakota law, then, that's going to include both simple assaults and aggravated assaults. So now, we've elevated every single bar fight in this state to a situation in which deadly force is authorized. You may not think that's what you're trying to do, but that's what the words say.
Senator Helene Duhamel works with law enforcement in Pennington County, and she also opposes the bill. She says on the upside, the bill clarifies that protected property includes outbuildings. But she says the 5-page bill isn't necessary to clean up 5 paragraphs of admittedly outdated language. Duhamel notes that the South Dakota State's Attorneys Association does not support the Stand Your Ground law. She says as she understands it, someone breaking into a storage facility or a U-Haul could be shot.
If the only way to stop you from stealing my property is to kill you, Section 9 says that's okay. It's justifiable homicide. It doesn't say the response has to be proportionate to the threat.
She says someone who appears to be breaking into a building could be a teen sneaking into a house to see a friend or a neighbor who lost the house key.
In a way, I feel like this bill is taking us back to the Wild West. Don't call the cops, just open fire.
Duhamel asks her fellow senators to defeat the bill. But the Senate passes the Stand Your Ground legislation by 21-14, and the bill has finished its journey through the South Dakota State Legislature. If it takes effect, the attorneys say the old justifiable homicide laws and the case law analyzing them will no longer exist. Courts will start over settling civil lawsuits and challenges to criminal charges that arise from this new statute. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
You can find that story and more from Victoria Wicks on our website, sdpb.org/news. Kevin Wooster is with us next. We're going to talk about some of those healthcare workers who came out of retirement to help us get our vaccinations. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. A proposed law in Kentucky would make it illegal to insult a police officer. Many say the bill would threaten freedom of speech.
Also, 1 year ago, the NBA canceled all games and suspended the season after a player tested positive for coronavirus. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by ReliaBank. Personal and business banking solutions. Reliable services. And a friendly welcome at 9 locations across eastern South Dakota. ReliaBank. A brighter banking experience since 1920. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender.
On the next Fresh Air, John Batiste. He's the music director and band leader on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and he composed, arranged, and performs the jazz in the animated film Soul. In New York, after George Floyd was killed, he led peaceful protesters in hymns and songs. Now he has a new album called We Are. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting Voting Why It Matters, featuring virtual events with authors, activists, and scholars, including Gloria Steinem, Louise Erdrich, and Thomas E. Patterson. More at sdhumanities.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. I'm Lori Walsh. As we look back on a year of COVID in South Dakota, we honor the healthcare workers who risked everything to work and heal during a pandemic. Their work, however, is far from done. And some of those workers came out of retirement to be part of that effort, including the effort to vaccinate. Kevin Wooster joins us now. You can find his story online at sdpb.org/Wooster. Hey, Kevin, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back. Always, especially great to be back with some good news or some happy news.
Some optimism after a year of of wondering when the next hopeful moment would come. And you've been hanging out at the vaccine clinic in Rapid City.
I love that place.
And, yeah.
As I'm writing this blog piece, pretty much everybody, I've got four people, three nurses, one of them also a nurse practitioner and a doctor, all in my age group, 65 to 70 years old, all retired from anywhere from a few months to 5 years, all came back, all felt called to come back and be part of this effort against this virus, and especially and in particular this vaccination effort, which is, you know, they all in one way or another called this one of the happiest work environments they've ever been in. And I got to tell you, I've been out there three times. I'm going back today. I'm looking for reasons to go back there other than to get my shot, which I get my second shot on Monday. And I'm excited about that. But you just walk in there and it's this hopeful, vibrant, unified place, and that's unified meaning the staff and also the people that are coming in to get their shots. It's in this divisive world, in this negative place that we often call our community, on politics and all that kind of stuff, there's a sense of unity and community there. Yeah. I love.
I went to get my first shot through the VA. And when I came in, I was talking to the nurse there. So I always have one standard experience when I go to the VA, Kevin, and that is that you get stared at because, you know, like, not by the staff. The staff is really good at understanding that women are veterans too, but you sit down in the waiting room, you're the only female, and like all the guys are looking at you again saying, what is she doing here? And you're just like, okay. So that's the first experience you have. And then, but the nurse who was giving me the shot, his name is Benjamin, and he just said, I miss the veteran. Like, I miss talking to people. So we were just chatting. You know, there was no line at that clinic that day. And just thinking about healthcare workers and what they've been through and just how glorious it is for them to be sitting there just doing this really cool thing of giving shot after shot after shot.
Yeah.
And they're working some long hours. Tell me who you met.
They are. Well, you know, there were three people, three that were nurses and a practitioner. And you know, I met Diane Kuhn first, and she's 65, a nurse, and went on to be a nurse practitioner. And she's, you know, 42 years with Monument as a nurse and then a nurse practitioner. And has a nice place south of town with her husband that she calls the Oasis, and they were going to hang out there and, you know, had some retirement volunteer work. But more and more, she felt from the start of this, she felt called to be back in this, to be part of this again. And she talked about feeling helpless during the pandemic because all of her former coworkers were working and being productive and fighting these things. And, you know, but her husband and she were both they hadn't had shots yet, of course, at that time during that. And they were concerned about coming back in. Nobody was exactly sure what the risk would be to them. And so they were talking about that. And then this opportunity came up, and she jumped at it. And she's working 3 days a week, 6:30 a.m. to 4. And they went, you know, they all get to pick their hours. There's one here, Karen Carpenter, that works four 10-hour shifts a week. She's 66, retired after 40 years in nursing. And, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, she said that was a wake-up call for her 66-year-old body after not working. But the good news is the day off, and Wednesday, she spends with her 2.5-year-old granddaughter, Evie, and she said, we just play all day. So I'm ready for the second 2 days after that. And you know, everybody that I talk to just says that when they get recruited, when the word comes that they're interested, and the recruiting nurse, whoever calls, they just say, name your hours, name the way you want to do it, you're hired. And you're on, you know, and that's basically what they do, and they all make it work, and it's working just great, you know.
It seems like every clinic that I've heard people have gone to has been a well-oiled machine. Yeah.
Amazing. You know, I talked about that when I went in. Maybe you had this experience. You have to sit for 15 minutes after the shot to make sure there's no reaction. With that 15 minutes, I was in and out of there in 20 minutes. You go through this line, they keep it moving, and, you know, that's also part of the happy mood there. People aren't sitting around for half an hour waiting or wondering.
Right.
They come in, they get moved right away to the waiting area, somebody comes and gets them right away, takes them to one of the stalls with the curtains, bada bing, bada boom, this little tiny needle that you, honestly, I didn't feel it go in. If I hadn't been watching it, I wouldn't have known it went in, and then you're on your way out, so...
Yeah, that was my experience too. The needle it does not even feel like you've got a shot. I mean, different people have different reactions after that, but the shot itself is certainly not something that maybe it's the euphoria of being. Maybe it's the same exact shot as every other shot, but this one you don't care, and so therefore the endorphins block it or something. I don't know.
I have a reaction, you know, because sometimes on the second shot you don't feel as good. And I kind of go with Dr. Kevin Weiland, a friend of mine here in Rapid City, who says, I want to feel a little nasty after I have his second shot. I want to know my body, you know, taking on what it thinks is that virus. So.
Yeah. You want to know that it's mounting its immune response.
Yeah.
Only not so much that I can't do the things
not so
I want
much
to
you
do.
Can't get out of bed, but.
We're so demanding, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We like to pick it all the way we want it, however that goes.
But, you know, we had Kim Molson-Risden, Secretary of the Department of Health, on yesterday, and she said 65 and older, it was 70% of 65 and older people in the state have been vaccinated. That seems huge to me that 70% of people 65 and older said yes, showed up, got their shots, at least their first shots, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I called my brother Jim today, because I call him, and, you know, he'll be 81 this summer, and he's had his shots down there, and he was out walking, and because I asked about the coffee group, which includes former Mayor Dave Munson and Jim and some other guys, and I try to get to them together with them when I'm in Sioux Falls. And I said, so now that you've got your shots, because I think Munson has his, Jim has his, both of them. So he said, well, we've already met at the park. We sat out there, and, you know, we're being careful about this, but we think pretty soon here, after it's been a while since that second shot, we're going to be able to find a place where we can go sit in the corner somewhere and talk to each other and have coffee like we did a year ago.
And
he's excited about it, and other people, I'm excited about it, you know. The Mays boys, you know them, you've fished with them. They've had their shots, they're in their 70s. After my shot, 10 days, I'm going to start looking for a little hot chai with the Mays boys again, so.
Nice. Is that what you miss the most, is gathering with just sitting across the table from somebody and talking? Like, what do you miss the most? What are you looking forward to the most when you feel like, I mean, not all at once, but.
That a lot, you know, the political talk, the just something hot between your hands on the table, talking over the steam and to be of the other thing is I'm wearing some pants that don't fit me very well yet, because I just don't do very much. I've lost some weight, and one of the things I'm going to do is shop more leisurely when I go out. I mean, I can go in and shop, but I don't hang around very long, and if people, especially people without masks, are around me, I leave pretty quickly, and I look forward to going in and feeling a little bit more comfortable with that. Going to the library, going to the Y, I'm in the YMCA here. Haven't been in the library in almost that much time. I just didn't want to. Some people have, but I didn't want to.
Yeah. I can't wait to go to a movie. I want to go to a movie theater when there's people. Yeah. There's people at the movie theater. Yeah. My brother actually rented a movie theater for us. I don't know, around Christmas time when they had that, you could just reserve the theater. And so we, just like three of us, I suppose there was probably 5 to 7 of us, all went in, sat at, you know, far separate parts of the theater and watched Wonder Woman, because we're like, whatever, the movie doesn't matter. We just want to be in the theater eating popcorn, and we did. So
yeah,
I can't wait to just say, what's playing this weekend? Let's go.
Absolutely. Mary and I haven't gone out to eat for a year. I mean, that's the way we played it. For some, we did a lot of carry out. We went in to try and help businesses and things like that, and drive throughs and things. But
yeah, me too.
Do that and go to the Doll and watch some young musicians play in a little theater area.
Music. I also want you have to go back to one of these clinics when the college students are there, because I'm told, you know, that the environment is very jubilant and joyful already. But I really do want to see, you know, a clinic full of 20-year-olds getting their first and second shot. I just think that that's another fun story to tune in for. Kevin Wooster, thank you so much for being here. Get that second shot and lay low and then hug those grandkids.
I want to feel nasty on Monday night. Okay.
All right. I'll check in with you then.
Not too nasty.
You can find Kevin Wooster's work on our website at sdpb.org/Wooster. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. On tomorrow's program, the debate over COVID-19 mitigation efforts often centers around words like liberty and freedom. It's been more about the Constitution than about science. The crisis isn't over. Neither is the debate. We're going to talk tomorrow to Dean Neil Fulton of the USD School of Law and Professor Emeritus Frank Pommersheim, also with the School of Law. We'll ask both of them about the U.S. Constitution, the response of a governor, and the individualism of an American pandemic. For Steve Zwemke and Chris Loffrey and Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.